You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, November 30th, 2016, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Evening, folks.
Guys, 2 weeks until Rogue One comes out.
I'm glad you brought that up, Steve. One of the most important... this is becoming like the important month of the year, not because Christmas, but because... With Christmas coming and all. But because it's going to be like the Star Wars drop month, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, you think it's always just going to be in December now?
Probably. Right?
That seems to be the pattern,
makes
yeah.
Sense. I thought I read that there is not going to be... Is Rogue One like a one-off?
Yes, it
yeah.
is.
Yeah.
It is, right? Yeah.
One and done.
Every other year, they're going to do the arc... movies. Like, so episode 7 was last year, episode 8 is next year, and then episode 9 will be 2 years from that. And then on the off years, they're doing these one-off, like, Star Wars stories. So it's like right. a Star Wars saga, but it's not part of the arc. So, and
gotcha.
This is great, because, you know, they're covering the rebellion just getting started and stealing the plans for the Death Star. I think they could take more chances. They could be more gritty. You know, we don't
right.
have these main characters that we have to care about and can't get killed or whatever. So,
that's right.
I mean, every character in this movie could be dead by the end. You know what I mean?
So these are all. So none of the characters that we know are going to make cameos in any of these films.
Well, we don't know that. There may be cameos.
Gotcha.
You know, Darth Vader.
I think Darth.
Oh, but all of the characters that we find ourselves connected to in these one-off films,
like Jar Jar,
are not part of the
yeah.
main.
Jar Jar is all over this movie.
Oh, I can't wait for the Jar Jar one-off.
Kara, they're gonna. You know, they're doing like a Han Solo. Single shot movie. They're going to do probably Boba Fett single shot movie.
Oh, interesting. But they won't use the same. They'll just cast somebody completely.
Oh, yeah. It'll be young versions of all these people, without a doubt.
But we've already seen young versions of them.
Yeah, but
at
it's not young
Boba
anymore.
Fett.
They've already cast, right? Didn't they already cast Han Solo?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, they did.
Alden Ehrenreich?
Yeah, he was in. That actor was in the Hail Caesar, the latest Coen Brothers movie. He was quite good. And he's going to be Han Solo in the one-off coming up in a few years.
I like that these two new movies, the first two new Star Wars that came out since, you know, the prequels, are like female leads.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
it's
sure.
It's pretty cool. It's like a great decision that they made.
Yeah, especially since the original movies were... so light, you know, like
mm-hmm. yeah
the joke
it was like
the
damsel
yeah Princess Leia is the only female in the galaxy basically
yeah.
but I think they're balancing the score a little bit, which totally
yeah,
makes sense because it's
it,
you know, the other thing is if you're being taken out of like our culture mm-hmm. you don't want assumptions from our culture to carry over thoughtlessly, you know.
Yeah,
so
right.
yeah for fantasy or science fiction shows like this, you want to do things that definitely take you out of your own comfort zone and your own culture.
Jar Jar the movie.
Yeah.
Stop. Well, and I love that not only are both of them super strong female leads, they, like you said, there's nothing about them that's like stereotyped. Like they're total badasses. They're not wearing sexy clothes. They're just like cool, awesome women.
Not wearing chainmail bras.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Everything's not ripped, you know, very specifically to reveal body parts.
Do you guys think that sci-fi is a good venue to push issues like this, you know, like,
yeah.
you know,
have oh, absolutely.
Absolutely.
Roddenberry taught us that a long time ago.
Yeah, yeah, it's fantastic because you're outside of your own culture and it's safe in a way to because
exactly.
it's some other species who's challenging whatever issues of racism or gender or whatever.
And also because it's so easy to go the other way, and sci-fi provides, I think, a platform, like a Fifth Element type platform for just going overtly over the top gender roles and, you know, super sexy aliens and all that stuff, that it's great when the decision is made not to go that route in sci-fi.
Yeah. Yeah, just don't make your aliens, you know, be subtle. Don't make your aliens half black and half white.
Yeah, that was not
let that be your
subtle,
last battleground. Yeah. Yeah, it could be a little more subtle than that.
It is smart. Like, you know, yeah, you can completely get outside of these preconceived notions we have about race because you can make up new races in a sci-fi movie.
Yeah. Yep.
Which is great.
Exactly. That's one of the things I love about science fiction. All the commentary that goes over, it just goes over a lot of people's heads. Oh, it's just cool alien. But yeah, but you look a little deeper and they're it's a, like Steve said, it's a safe way to comment on modern society. A lot of science fiction is
well, that goes back to Jonathan Swift and Gulliver's Travels.
Sure.
I don't know if it goes before that, but that's the oldest you know, one that I personally know about, right? I mean, that was all commentary on his contemporary society, even though he was dealing with horses and Lilliputians.
Yahoos.
Yahoos, yeah. Great, brilliant. I mean, you know, if you haven't read the actual book, Gulliver's Travels, you definitely need to do that. It's brilliant. All right, let's get on with our show. Bob, you're going to start us off with a forgotten superhero of science.
Yes, this week I'm going to talk about Maria Telkis, 1900 to 1995. It's a good run. She was a physical chemist and biophysicist and a solar energy pioneer. Steve, you may be extra interested in this. She invented the solar distiller and designed the first modern home heated by solar energy. Telkis was raised in Budapest, where she got her BA and PhD. Then after moving to the United States, she worked for Westinghouse Electric, MIT, and she was even assigned to the U.S. Office of Scientific Research and Development during World War II. And it was in the 30s and 40s that her focus was solar energy, thermoelectric devices, pretty much her entire career. She created a solar distiller, probably one of her best inventions, that was used – it basically used the sun to evaporate seawater and then recondense it into water that you could drink. And that device was used in many, many life rafts during the war, probably saved a lot of lives, and was even made much larger to handle water production of the Virgin Islands for a period of time when they really needed some extra help. Let's see. She also, Telkis, along with architect Eleanor Raymond, designed and created the first modern solar heated home in 1948. Now, this wasn't, you know, fancy photovoltaics. I don't even think they really existed back then. This is basically the solar energy heated the air, and then the hot air was then pumped throughout the house. And get this, she even had a design that would transfer the heat to special salts to store the heat to use later. That is a fascinating solution to the problem that we have to this day. What do we do with stored solar energy? Where are we going to keep it for nighttime or whatever?
What's interesting is that, like, using the sun to directly heat water, for example, is actually really efficient, and for a long time was more efficient than photovoltaics. I don't know if photovoltaics have crossed over. They may still be more efficient than photovoltaics. I'm not sure, but I know last time I, you know, heard the comparison, it was actually more efficient. If what all you're doing is heating, you know what I mean?
Right. So yeah, so it's no wonder she was known as the Sun Queen or the Mother of the Solar Home. So remember Maria Telkis, mention her to your friends, perhaps when discussing the modal interaction of magnetoreluctance and capacitive directance.
Magnetoreluctance?
1900 to 1995, a few years shy of spanning three centuries.
Ah, yes.
Damn.
My daughter, my older daughter, was born in 1999.
She has a shot.
Yeah, Ashley was in 98, so she could.
They have good shots at it.
Yeah.
She could absolutely probably span millennia.
All right, Kara, this has been in the news quite a bit. I've been actually blogging about it quite a bit, too. You're going to tell us about fake news and online reasoning.
Yes, and I picked this story because you've been writing about it so much. So you did a blog recently about civic online reasoning, and it was based on this Stanford University study that was recently published. At Stanford, they looked at 7,804 student responses across 12 states, and they divided it up into three kind of big chunks: middle school students, high school students, and college students. And what they really wanted to see is if kids, is it fair to call them kids? Maybe I shouldn't do that. Is somebody going to be offended by that? Okay. Kids and college-age young adults are basically capable of utilizing a baloney detector. How literate are they when they're looking at online sources of news and other ways that information is presented online to be able to either tell outright if something seems fishy or to at least dig a little bit deeper below the surface to decide whether or not they should trust something at face value? And so opening up the study, they basically looked at a lot of different skill sets across these student groups. And the funny thing is that in the discussion section of this study, they mentioned that when they were first doing some of the item consistency and trying to come up with the analysis, because they had to do, just like many psychologists have to do, A lot of back and forth work with the professors and teachers in these different areas and testing with the students to make sure that their study questions were kind of on par, to make sure that they weren't too hard or too easy. When they were first coming up with ideas, they were like, oh, that they're going to see right through that. That's going to be super easy. And they were just like blown away by how illiterate most American students are when they're trying to discern fake news online. So obviously they scaled some of these things based on where they thought the level should be. Obviously a middle school student is not going to be quite as sophisticated as a college student. So a middle school student might be looking at a tweet and figuring out, or multiple tweets and figuring out which is the most trustworthy. Or they might be looking at a sponsored post and explaining why maybe you don't take what's written in a sponsored post, which we know is basically an advertisement, at face value.
Yeah, they were just asked, is this an ad? Mm-hmm. That's it. They were shown a the homepage of a website that had a real article, a clear advertisement, and then sponsored content. And they were asked for each of them, is this an ad? And why do you think it is?
Yeah, and then they were asked to explain why they would think so. And with that one specifically, kids were pretty much able to tell the difference, and these are middle school kids, between a real news story and an advertisement, but when something was blatantly labeled as, quote, sponsored content, they couldn't. They had a very hard time, and they assumed that it was news.
More than 80% thought it was news.
Whoa. Yeah. That does go to a deeper question of, do they know all of the tricks that the advertisers are using nowadays to kind of sneak advertising in under the radar, like using sponsored content, which I've always kind of had a really hard time with, especially on legitimate news sites.
Yeah, it's supposed to be deceptive, right? That's the whole
exactly
point.
Yeah, it's like they write sponsored content, usually I think legally towards, maybe not, I don't quote me on that, maybe it's not legally, but ethically somewhere towards the top, but that's it. Other than that, yeah, they'll use the same typeface, they'll use all of the same formatting, so it really looks like just any other news article that site would usually
they
post.
Blend it. They blend
they
it
blend
in.
They blend it in,
and
exactly. It's
so.
Camouflage, yeah, advertising.
Now, as a test, because I have a daughter who's in middle school, I asked her what sponsored content meant, and she did not know. So that is just not widely known that, you know, at that age, what sponsored content means. My high school student daughter knew exactly what that meant, but not middle school. So yeah, definitely they're not where we, I guess, where they thought they were.
And so then by high school, I guess that would be why they didn't do a sponsored content item in high school students. They did a couple of different, well, they did five different things across all of them. They did a lot of focus on Facebook in high school, which I thought was a little weird because I don't think most high schoolers are spending that much time on Facebook anymore.
but they did the Imgur one, which definitely is a high school.
Yes. Yeah. So that was a photo sharing website, right? Yeah. Images. And they showed a photo of these daisies and they were all like mutated looking. They had kind of horrible changes to them. And the caption of it said that this was the result of Fukushima. And the students were asked to decide if they should trust it or not. And obviously there's no context clues within that photo. There's no reason to think that photo, you know, was taken at that time, was taken in that location, had anything to do with that. It could have just been a natural aberration. They also had them do, like I said, a couple of things on Facebook. They had them evaluate two posts from a newspaper's comment section. They even had them, they did have them look at a sponsored post also, and in this case determine which one was more reliable, a legitimate news story and a sponsored post. And then at the college level, things became even more sophisticated. At the college level, they actually changed their parameters a little bit, and they even mention in the summary that they knew that they were going to take a little bit of flack for this, but at the middle school and high school levels, they took articles, online articles, and they printed them. And they had students make these kinds of determinations based on physical paper versions of those online articles. Now, obviously, you know, you're going to get a little bit of pushback in doing that because it's not as close to what an online experience would actually be, but they did that so they could include students from lower income neighborhoods who might not easily have access to the internet all the time. At the college level, there was the assumption that college universities would have internet access, and that was kind of required, a required part of your education. So then they were doing free web searches, and that's when things, I think, got even more interesting, in that they would go to a website and determine whether or not that website should be trusted. They would go to a partisan website and make that same determination. They would research a specific claim online, and they focused a lot on social media. You know, is this tweet a useful source of information? Why or why not? And what they found is that although sometimes college students were able to make basic determinations based on clues that were offered within that tweet or within that post, they often did not click beyond the post, even if it was littered with hyperlinks.
Yeah, that's the thing. Most did not click through.
Yeah, and even the ones that did click through, most of them then didn't do any sort of independent searching. They would only go to the links that were provided within the article, which is a little redundant. They wouldn't like look outside of that or dig any deeper. So, you know, obviously the conclusions here are that things are a bit bleak. They actually use that term in the executive summary. I just want to read a quick summary here. When thousands of students respond to dozens of tasks, there are endless variations. That was certainly the case in our experience. However, at each level, middle school, high school, and college, these variations paled in comparison to a stunning and dismaying consistency. Overall, young people's ability to reason about the information on the internet can be summed up in one word: bleak. And they go on to talk about how we may think of kids often as, quote, digital natives because they grew up with the internet at their fingertips. They've never known a card catalog world. But that doesn't mean that they possess the skills to determine real news from false news. And I think that assumption that they do just because they are digital natives is doing us a disservice in an educational setting. Yeah. A lot of these students are getting through school without these incredibly valuable life skills that, of course, as we know, are fundamental to being a good skeptic.
Well, I think that's the core thing here, Kara, is that it seems like schools are not adapting to modern society in this regard. You know, they're not teaching people how to think. They're not teaching people how to use the biggest tool that they're ever going to use, which is the internet. They don't take it seriously. I don't understand why governments, as an example, don't ask schools or make state schools teach people basic skills like how to use the internet and how to not get scammed.
I read another piece online. It's a really interesting piece that was first published on The Conversation and later picked up by Scientific American. The author's name is Filippo Menzker. Menzker, M-E-N-C-Z-E-R. And he is a computer scientist who actually studies how echo chambers work, how fake news spreads. He uses different algorithms. His lab has developed bot detectors to really understand, in being the perpetrators, setting up fake news sites and watching how many people click on them and how it gets shared around the internet, to understand that whole process and that whole system and really dig into the science behind it. And, you know, he makes a few comments in the article that are really frightening. One of them is that fake news spreads in a viral way the exact same as non-fake news. There's really no difference when you look at the effects of fake news on the internet between how people click, how people share. And a lot of times it comes down to the fact that people will share an article by only reading the headline and no deeper. And that's really frightening. Yep. It makes me think that we need to obviously change the way that we educate our students, change the way that we educate adults. You know, we've got to think about kind of the Facebook dilemma in a more serious way, which is that social media utilizes these algorithms to keep sending us the same things that we're most likely to click on. So the echo chambers are becoming more and more divided. And that's really worrisome.
Do you know that they've made statements? I mean, Zuckerberg is definitely, he's fully aware of the situation and making promises that they're going to fix the algorithm and kind of address it. Now, I think it's pretty obvious it's going to affect the income of the company if they truly do this.
Bottom line.
It will.
Yeah, Jay, an important point. I mean, he might have made promises to address the fake news, and that's great because it needs addressing. But I don't think he's going to necessarily address the whole echo chamber, feedback. That's just a, you know, how it works. And I don't see that really going anywhere soon.
Well, I don't know about that, Bob. I don't know, because let's make sure we're talking about the same thing here. I mean, the algorithms, the way that they work today, or, you know, the way that they very recently used to work, like we talked on the show previously, they're showing you things that they know you're going to be attracted to and that you're going to click on, right?
Of course.
But that's
hence
what we're talking
about. The echo chamber.
Right. I'm just checking that we're talking about the same thing.
Yeah, but what Zuckerberg has addressed was the fake news specifically, the fake news site specifically, not the whole echo chamber byproduct of how Facebook works. You know, right? Because Facebook wants to show you stuff that they're confident you will click on. So that's what it means.
It may very well, though, end up because this is all the rollout of social media and the evolution and progress of social media's impact on us. And I think if we pressure, you know, let the world know that we don't like this, that we should get a checkbox somewhere in our settings that lets us change the behavior of these platforms.
Yeah, I mean, Google offers you an option to do an incognito search, right? Which is like take all of what they know about your search preferences away so that they'll show you what any other person, like a Google native, not native, a Google newcomer would actually see when they first put something in the search box. And it would be great to be able to see that within our own social media streams. At the same time, it makes me wonder if users would even want that. And that's, I think, the core of the problem.
Give the people what they want.
Yes, it's not that, you know, these, well, it's both. It's that these big organizations are utilizing these algorithms, but the reason they're doing it is because it helps them make more money. And the reason they can make more money in many ways is because they are giving the people what they want. And so how do we change that?
Education.
How do we change? It's got to be education.
Right.
And unfortunately, I think it's going to have to fly in the face of political pressure. Like, we're going to have to ensure that our calls to Congress and our choices about the way that we would like to see government regulate how, especially in public schools, how we change education are stronger than the lobbyists who want to keep the status quo, because this is obviously a tool that is sometimes used politically. Fake news can help politicians. You know, it's interesting when I look at your article, Steve, some of the comments, there's a few really like good curated comments at the end of the piece. And one of them is from, the gorilla. And, he says that, or she, could be a she, that they went to a way too expensive private high school and had actual courses for both library use, like how to conduct research and use databases, and critically evaluating the content of articles and web pages and papers. And they had two required critical thinking courses.
Wow.
And that was similarly mirrored in a university. And they said the importance of this is well understood by universities and pretentious high schools. But for the majority of school districts, he's not sure how it would be possible. And that's the part that I think is really frustrating, is that we're seeing a bigger and bigger class divide.
I think it has to be part of the core curriculum. You know, that's
it
the,
has
the
to be. It absolutely
But what's interesting,
be.
I read through all of, because they actually, in the study, they didn't just give you numbers. They actually showed you actual sample responses mm-hmm. from students, what they wrote down in their
analysis. And they showed
analysis.
You exactly
yeah.
how they presented it to the
now,
students, too.
Now, having... You know, again, very carefully following my two daughters going through public school, I recognize what a lot of the students were trying to do. I could see how, they're mimicking some lesson that they were given about this sort of thing, but they didn't really absorb it, and they don't know how to apply it to the real world. And I see that a lot as a shortcoming. The critical thinking and the science that's being taught, obviously there are great teachers out there, but the baseline is just so much lower than it should be. There's a lot of going through the motions, and there's a lot of times when I could tell that what they're supposed to be learning wasn't really conveyed. And I wonder if the teacher really knows what they're supposed to be learning from what they're doing. You know, I feel like they're just memorizing the superficial aspects of it. And that's what these kids were doing. They were echoing back snippets of what they were told about what they were supposed to do, but they didn't really have an understanding of how to apply these principles in the real world to evaluate content. And that's just a straight up failure of education, and that's totally fixable. It's totally fixable, but we need the political will to do it.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, it's almost the difference between working with somebody as they work through a problem and verbalize it and go like, what is it that's sticking out to you? Let's try and talk about that and let's try and like narrow down on it. And somebody kind of looking at a rubric or a cheat sheet and going, which of these things is the most glaring problem with this article. Oh, I think it's number three, and this is why, you know? Because you can see that in some of their responses. Like, like the reasoning isn't quite there. Like this, here's a good one. It is an advertisement because it advertises something.
Yeah,
like, you know, circular. Yeah. It's hard to get deeper into that. Or it's an advertisement because there's no really useful thing in it. So they're seeing the word useful and thinking that that is probably the best way to gauge it, which is like a very low information way to do
it. Exactly.
Oh, look at this one. It is not an advertisement because it does not have a blue button on top.
Ooh.
A little concrete, yeah. Yeah, so yeah, we're as a society, we're still navigating through all of this stuff, how social media is changing how we access information, what skills do we need, what filters do we need, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And we're in the middle of it. I think, you know, social media was a truly disruptive technology, and we haven't – the thing is, what I'm concerned about is that by the time we figure out what to do about it, there'll be something else, you know, that'll be even more disruptive. Let's move on. So this is December, or when this comes out, it'll be in December. And we often will talk about something to do with Christmas. There's always some controversy going on. There was an interesting article written in Lancet Psychiatry by a couple of psychiatrists who are asking the question, is it immoral and is it harmful to deceive children about the existence of Santa Claus, to lie to them to promote the Santa myth when they are younger? And this is, you know, it's actually got a lot of comments when I wrote about this. This is very, I think, controversial. People are basically falling into two camps who are like, yeah, lying, you know, to your kids and deceiving them, you know, about some magical thing is wrong, and, you know, there's no reason to do it. And then other people, you know, on the side of it's benign, they figure it out on their own, it's fine, don't worry about it. So the psychiatrists were definitely in the, this is immoral and harmful end of the spectrum. But I thought that they actually, that their argument was very poorly argued, and I fundamentally disagreed with them. And I think they were coming at this without explicitly saying so, I think from a religious point of view, and I think that tainted their approach. Although interestingly, they quote Richard Dawkins in their article. But so a couple of things led me to that conclusion. One is they give as an example of a benign lie, a white lie, an adult comforting a child and telling them that their recently deceased pet will go to a special place, animal heaven. They say that's arguably nicer than telling graphic truths about its imminent re-entry into the carbon cycle. So to them, that's okay. It's okay to lie to kids about their dog going to heaven rather than just being part of the cycle of life. But telling them about Santa Claus, that's you know, a persistent deception that is going to harm your child. And
what?
Right? Yeah.
To me, that's like.
Deeper in the article, this is just to complete my thought. Deeper in the article, they say if adults have been lying about Santa, even though it has usually been well intentioned, what else is a lie? If Santa isn't real, are fairies real? Is magic? Is God? And my response is yeah. Exactly. That's exactly what we want children to be questioning. They actually say in their article that if you lie about Santa, when your kids figure it out, can they be relied upon to continue as the guardians of wisdom and truth? So,
But that's the whole point of growing up is learning when you can start questioning authority.
There are no guardians of wisdom and truth. Yeah, that's the point.
That was my main comment, was since when did we ever think of our parents as the guardians of wisdom and truth?
Well, we do when we're young, and then we realize they're fallible. That's like a hallmark of growing up.
Yeah, but that's you do when you're young, and you certainly do not when you're a teenager.
That is so true.
Yeah. It's actually much more variable than the standard cliche, but yeah, that there is that trend.
Yeah.
But
unless you're really protected from the outside world.
Kids are variable. They don't always fall into the stereotypes. But so, yeah, so I think that sort of the two sides here, not to create a false dichotomy, but the two basic positions that I see people taking in all the comments, if you think that questioning authority and not believing your parents is a good thing, you're like, yeah, tell them about Santa. They'll figure it out on their own. And then they know to be skeptical of everything, and they shouldn't trust any authority. And that's a good thing. Versus, oh, but if they start to question Santa, then they're going to be going to ruin their faith in your authority. They might even start questioning God. So that, I think, was I think, where the divide mainly is. But that does leave an interesting question for people who are basically skeptical. How do you handle the Santa? And I get, we get asked this question every single year.
Every
how do you guys,
year. Yep.
How do you handle the whole Santa thing? So a lot of people described what they did with their kids, and there definitely is this compromise in the middle, which is what I did, what my wife and I did, which was to never directly lie to our kids about Santa, but never tell them that Santa isn't real either. They absorb it from the culture, and we just, you know, don't confirm or deny and let them think what they're going to think. And then when they start to ask questions about it, which they inevitably do, I encourage their skepticism. It's like, that's a great question. How does that work? I wonder. That's very interesting. You should be questioning that.
Yeah, so you kind of ask them questions like, well, what do you think about
when
they come to you? Is Santa real? What do you think?
Which is no different than what I do about everything. You know, when all the time they were growing up, they asked me questions. I'm like, that's a really good question. How could we know what color the dinosaurs were or whatever? Let's explore that together. I never put myself forward as the authority. I never just gave them the answer, ever. You know, it's always, let's explore this. Let's think about how we could know this answer. And the same thing, Santa's no different. The other, another way to deal with this, which is something that we did as well, is you sort of treat Santa, without saying he's not real, you kind of treat him as a fictional character. For example, kids know that Mickey Mouse isn't real, right? I mean, there isn't this cultural mythology that Mickey Mouse is real. But, you know, we went to Disney World, and the kids were damn excited to see that actor in a Mickey Mouse costume. You know what I mean?
Like, for sure.
I think that they knowingly engage in the game. They play along,
right.
And it's fun for them, even though they know that's not really Mickey Mouse. They may not.
Yeah, it's only when they're
at what
really
age, though, Steve? At what age?
No, I mean, it's only when they're like 2, 3. They might not have, maybe 4. They don't have as much of a understanding of reality.
They're barely sentient at that age. I mean, it's not even worth worrying about at that age.
Yeah, it's like just jingle something shiny in front of their
But Steve, some would argue that talking about Santa as if he were real is you essentially telling them he is real.
But I never did that.
Well, you play along with it. I mean, there is, because I, you know, in my personal experience, this is an anecdote, whatever. But I didn't get all screwed up because I believed in Santa when I was a kid. It was fun, and then it went away, just like all the other stupid things I believed in.
Exactly.
Before I had logic.
Yeah.
And I have something else to say. One thing I really don't like about Santa is the fact that like,
bastard.
Hey, Santa's the guy that's given you all of your toys, and we don't talk about gift giving and receiving, right? So, you know, my wife and I have been talking about this. Like, yeah, Santa's going to give my children gifts. Like, let's talk about my close to 4-year-old son now. He's going to get 1 or 2 gifts from Santa, and we'll chit chat a little bit about Santa and all that. But my son is going to come out with me and buy presents for his mom and his grandparents, and I'm going to teach him what it means.
Yeah.
To,
and his favorite uncle.
Or do a craft. Yeah, definitely. But do, you know, make something for people and wrap it. And I want him to get excited about the gift giving aspect. I hate the idea that it's like, oh, Santa's, all your presents come from him. Mom and dad did nothing. Your grandparents did nothing.
I agree with that. Yeah. So like what we did is, like, first of all, we would have the wrapped presents under the tree for weeks, right? So there was none of this, like, they all appear on Christmas Eve. And we would have, most of the gifts were from mom and dad or from actual people. There were a couple of gifts from fictional characters. Sometimes it was Santa. One year, all of the gifts that were from fictional characters were from the Doctor. Because we were watching Doctor Who, and they loved it, and
makes
I played
sense.
The TARDIS sound at night.
Oh,
you know?
My God.
And of course, it was all a game,
a
and they knew it was a game.
Roof?
Yeah, exactly. The Doctor showed
Holy
up in his TARDIS
crap.
And left, and they were all nerd gifts about Doctor Who and everything. But
that's awesome.
So that's,
You're
it's
so
all,
fun.
It's all a game, and they love it, and there's no trauma involved at any step.
No.
I think the only time... The only time there might be some trauma is if, which is benign in my opinion, is if a kid, you know, believes later than sort of their peers, and their peers break it to them and make fun of them for it. That I could see, you know, that would not be pleasant.
Yeah.
I don't know if I even buy into any of this, you know, injured by believing in Santa nonsense. I don't really buy it.
I agree.
It just seems like the whole, you know, easily offended crowd, you know?
Well, oh, I think it's more that, like, little kids are incredibly cruel and they're sensitive because they're selfish. Like, little kids have a selfish disposition. Oftentimes, they're concerned about themselves. And at school, if you raise a child to overtly not believe, or you tell a child, I think this is the risk. If you tell a child Santa's not real from the time they're born, they may be deemed to be jerks because they're going to feel like, oh no, I need to let everybody know that they're being lied to. And then those parents are going to be mad, but also the kids might feel bullied if they're the only person in school who is like in on it. So I feel like if you are going to be a parent who chooses not to tell your children about Santa Claus, you also have to help your child understand why it is that the other kids do believe and how it's not their place to take that away from them.
Yeah, but you can't say that to a 2- and 3-year-old, not even
exactly.
Close.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but so
2 and 3, who cares? It doesn't matter. It's when they get to 6, 7, 8.
5, 6 years.
Yeah, then where the kids start to separate out. But whatever, that's why if you strike that balance between this is the fun of the season and, you know, this is whatever. Santa's part of the mythology of Christmas. It's all part of the fun. We don't ruin it for other people. But, you know, as soon as they start thinking critically about it, you encourage that. And you know, you could choose if you want to participate in it, or we chose not to reinforce it. But the thing is, you don't have to. You don't have to lie to your kids about it. They're going to completely absorb it from the culture without you doing anything.
And also, let's not forget that there's a whole segment of the culture that doesn't believe in Santa because they're not Christian, or they're not kind of like default Christian, like non-believing Christian. Jews don't celebrate Christmas.
Yeah. They celebrate the...
like, we forget about that.
Yeah, we celebrate a secular Christmas.
Christmas.
But that has
but Jews
a
don't.
Lot of the, like, the traditions that were pagan and then were taken over by the Christians, even though some of them still deny it. They're basically pre-Christian, pagan traditions, and, and we celebrate those, you know. That.
But regardless of that, like, all of my Jewish friends, now I get it, growing up in Texas, I had like 2 friends that were Jewish. Now that I live in L.A., our Christmas, because we don't like to travel at Christmas and we have sort of an orphan Christmas for all of our friends that are home, is like 75% Jews because that's the only people that are home on Christmas. But they don't grow up with Santa. How do their parents handle it? Why aren't we learning from the people who already have conquered
this? They get
this?
8 days of presents, right?
That's right. Damn right.
Or as Lewis Black says, it's a crappy back to school holiday. Do you guys ever see that stand-up? Where he's like, I got a pen. I got a notebook. This is horrible.
The other angle to this, just to close this out, is the notion that Santa is judging the children and is going to reward them, you know, if they're good and punish them if they're naughty. I agree that that's kind of an unsavory aspect of it. I think we never did that. We would never say, you better be good or Santa's not giving you any presents. Because first of all, it's an empty threat. I don't believe in empty threats. The kids know they're going to get freaking presents at Christmas. You're never going to pull the trigger on that. Sorry, you were naughty
last
week.
Fill right. Yeah.
They know you're not going to pull the trigger on that. So, and you wouldn't, because it would be cruel and unusual. So just, I just think you should... My opinion, the one thing I agree with them on is you shouldn't use it as a threat to be good. I think
that's right.
I don't know.
That's why we have
it works.
No. That's why we are, but
there are other more effective
mommy and daddy won't give you presents.
There are more effective things. You can use Krampus as that. As that.
Oh,
the monster
yeah.
will come and take you away in the middle of the
Krampus
night.
Krampus rocks.
The person I work with was telling me about this shelf elf, you know, the thing that's
elf
watching.
On the shelf,
Yeah, like Santa's like totally
they're a spy.
Eyes on the ground like that. I don't like the creepy factor of that. I think it's very weird. I really don't
it
like
is weird.
It.
Weird.
Big brother, big
yeah,
Santa.
They brought that up.
Big, big, big Santa. How about this,
nice.
Guys? The holidays are to enjoy yourself with you, your family, you know, like it should revolve around the time you have with the people you love and food and all that. And all this other stuff is just noise. Forget about it.
Well, and it's a personal choice. It's a personal choice. And I'll tell you what, my mom still gives me a couple presents from Santa every year, and I think it's cute.
Yeah.
She always signs her presents, some of them from mom and some of them from Santa.
That's adorable.
If she well, sends presents,
it's in your
name.
It's in your name, so
it is in my name. That's true.
That makes sense. Nice. Like getting a little book from Steve.
Oh my God! I just realized, of course, your middle name is Santa. Yeah. Holy crap!
No, it's my part of my last name. Well, whatever. My middle name is Louise. But I did get that a lot when I was a kid.
All right, Jay, this is a really cool item. You're going to tell us about farmer ants.
Yeah, so farmer ants, guys. Did you guys know that ants could farm?
Yes, I did.
It's pretty damn cool. So there's a paper that was published in the journal Nature. It points out that the ant species known as the Fijian?
Fijian
ant. The technical
Fijian?
Term
Fijian.
Fijian. Fijian.
Fijian.
Fijian. Fijian. Fijian ant. The technical
Fijian.
Name is, there it is. Thank you, Evan.
Fijian.
Fijian.
So it's the Philodrus nagasaw. That's the technical name. And cool. They're small black ants. They live in Fiji. And they've been wearing overalls for about 3 million years, acting as farmers.
Is that all?
So yeah, so this particular ant, they traced it back to 3 million years, which is really long time. But I did find out there was another ant, a leafcutter ant, that had been doing some type of quote unquote plant farming for about 8 million years. But the ant we're talking about today has a unique behavior that they found, which I think is really interesting. It's pretty cool, and it is unique. So their plant of choice is a squamularia plant, and it's more like a lichen or a fungus because it forms these brown, semi-round protrusions from the cracks and joints in trees. And the ants plant seeds in soft spots like those, you know, those areas where there's cracks or you know, branches make a V. They also fertilize the seeds after they put them there, and they fight off other insects to protect the plants. Now, these plants grow. They eat the interior of the plant, and they turn the plant into their home. And that
grow their home.
Yep, and that home becomes the home of, you know, that colony of ants. And they're, you know, all over the tree at that point. Then there could be a lot of ant colonies living off of the same tree. And I guess, you know, they just keep growing, and then more ant colonies form as time goes on. There was a few things I found out I thought were very interesting. So some ants have domesticated animals. Did you guys ever hear about that?
That's what I thought you were going to talk about, were the ants and aphids.
Aphids,
I heard of aphids.
Super cool. Pretty
right, slick. That was it. So they eat the sugary secretions that the aphids have, and they pet them. Like, they stroke them.
They tickle them.
With their with their
and
antenna.
The aphids squirted out their anus.
Yep.
And that's and then they eat it.
That's funny.
Isn't
that's
nature
real, huh?
Wonderful?
The things you do to survive, right, Steve?
Richard Attenborough saying that.
Yes.
Oh, there goes its sphincter again.
So apparently, in another unique aspect to these insects are that they're the only ones that have like a 100% dependency on this plant to provide them the food and their home, which, you know, it's that relationship that has not been seen before, so it's unique.
I just realized I said Richard Attenborough and not David Attenborough.
What this item made me think about, this is just a question, I couldn't find an answer to this, maybe probably don't know, is I wonder if the ants over the 3 million years have actually cultivated the plant. Is the plant different because they're choosing the best seeds or whatever? Or, you know, obviously there may have been some co-evolution going on, but beyond co-evolution, have the ants been directing the evolution of this plant just like we do to our agriculture?
Artificial selection in a way?
It's possible. Yeah. You know, they could have been picking ones that grow faster and bigger or whatever. Yeah, yeah. You don't know. You know, it's hard to think about it in non-human terms because we would be very mindful about it. But, you know, maybe because the ant colonies were more successful, that lived maybe in one that grew faster or whatever, that some evolution was happening, sure.
Yeah, that's very, very cool. Bob, tell us about these diamond batteries.
Yeah, this one was awesome. So researchers from the University of Bristol, they have built a prototype battery of man-made diamond from a radioactive material. Nickel in this case, which is a proof of concept. So they hope to make an impact on nuclear waste,
clean electricity, and battery life all in one fell swoop with this thing. So what I'm talking about here is four words, nuclear-powered diamond battery. And that just sounds so awesome.
I mean, you know.
And the reality of this thing is almost as cool as it sounds, but not quite. Interesting. I mean, maybe I'll just bottom line it right here before you get too excited. It's not going to power your smartphones, but what it does power, it could do for thousands of years. But so the question then is, how do you make a battery, even a weak one, that lasts for centuries or millennia? It's called beta voltaics and alpha voltaics. It uses low-level radioactivity to generate electricity. Smoke detectors work using radioactive decay. Early pacemakers were powered by beta voltaics using the decay of promethium. So the specific idea, though, that they're using is pretty novel and fascinating. So it all starts with nuclear reactors that use graphite blocks as moderators. They moderate and control the nuclear reactions, control the heat, control the flow. Very important stuff for this subset of nuclear reactors. But after years, the graphite becomes radioactive and it has to be dealt with. So now the worst of the graphite is in the outer layers that they've identified. A lot of it, or a good chunk of it, has turned into radioactive carbon-14, which is the worst of the radioactivity of the graphite. So their plan then is to heat the graphite, and the outer layers of the radioactive carbon-14 turns into a gas, and that gas can then be relatively easily turned into man-made diamonds. So they're taking this carbon-14 gas, and it's carbon, so they could basically turn it into man-made diamonds. So now what you have left, you have these radioactive diamonds on one hand, and the graphite blocks that without the carbon-14 are now less radioactive. They're cheaper, easier, and just easier to deal with in general, because the nastiest part of the radioactivity is now gone. But you've got these radioactive diamonds, and this is the cool part of it. Now, artificial diamonds themselves, they are known to create small electric currents when exposed to radiation. Take the diamond, put it within a radioactive field, and you've got current. But these diamonds are made of radioactive material, so they just spew electrons just sitting there. You don't have to do anything with them, and they're radioactive. This is beta radiation, basically electrons. It's short range, but you still would not want to touch it or eat it. That would not be good. So the final step of this whole process is to encase the radioactive diamond inside another non-radioactive man-made diamond, which will absorb all the radiation and make the whole thing less radioactive than a banana. Literally, mm-hmm. A banana has more radioactivity that's detectable than this diamond battery.
I love those comparisons.
Yeah, right. Just totally puts it into perspective.
Less radioactive than a banana.
Are you afraid of bananas? That is no, the, that don't is the be standard. Afraid of this.
Hey, so, we call it one banana unit.
So you now have a nuclear-powered diamond battery. Professor Scott, Tom Scott, is a member of the Cabot Institute, said there are no moving parts involved, no emissions generated, no maintenance required, just direct electricity generation. By encapsulating radioactive material inside diamonds, we turn a long-term problem of nuclear waste into a nuclear-powered battery and long-term supply of clean energy. So a lot of pluses to this. It's really interesting how it deals with so many separate issues. But the reality of it, though, it's weak. I mean, this is not, you're not going to run your iPhone off of this. Let's see if I can put it into perspective. So a one gram carbon-14 battery would produce about 15 joules per day. And that's far less than a AA battery.
So when you say joules, you mean diamonds, right?
No, J-O-U-L-E-S, very common measure.
Baba, what would a 10-pound diamond do?
That's what, I tried to figure that out. I tried, 10 pounds, I mean, multiply
right, so,
that.
So 1 gram, so if you had 1,000 grams, you had a kilogram, right?
Right.
It's like 2.2 pounds. A kilogram would be, so how many joules was it?
15 joules per gram.
So that would be 15,000 joules per kilogram. How much is that? I mean, do you have a sense of, like, what could you power that off of that?
No, but I was going to talk about that at the end of my talk, and I totally agree, Steve. If you took a chunk of this, and you could still wrap even like a brick size amount in synthetic diamonds, say. I mean, it probably would be very expensive to do this, but if you could do that, so what are we talking about here? You know, in terms of, can I like put a bunch of these like, you know, in a shielded wall in my house and run my entire house for thousands of years type of thing? I would love to see what the extreme of this type of technology would do, where basically size and weight aren't a factor, obviously. But to put this into comparison, if you have a AA battery, say the battery can run for 24 hours, the diamond battery, using carbon-14, it has a half-life of 5,720 years. So this diamond battery will still be chugging along in almost six millennia, and it would only be half as effective as it is now. It would be essentially just as effective for centuries. So this is extremely long-term type of battery power, which of course makes what we're discussing, Steve, very interesting. What we could do if we scale this up in terms of size. So then, but of course, when you're talking about these diamond batteries, they haven't decided, are they going to be like 1 gram or more? They haven't decided how much carbon-14 would be in each diamond, but the applications are clearly something that's going to require low power for long periods of time that are just basically a pain in the ass to replace. So, you know, pacemakers, high altitude drones, satellites, possibly. What about interstellar probes that can no longer use solar energy because they're just too far away from our sun? That's a possibility. And as the company is even asking people, hey, give us your creative applications and ideas for these diamond batteries. And they say use hashtag diamond battery to let them know some wacky ideas to use this stuff. And I'm sure some stuff will come up that we're not thinking. But I still think about the time frame. Having a power source for centuries is just so compelling. And if we could do what, I'm just trying to wonder what we could do to scale it up and still make it safe. And imagine you could just burying 1,000 or 1 million of these little diamonds together, trying to make them work together. What is reasonable to expect? What could you achieve? What could you power? And what would it cost? I mean, that's diamonds. You know, they could make fake diamonds, you know, much more easily now than ever before. But still, you know, I don't know what they would cost. They still might be, you know, especially if you want 1,000 of them, what would this cost? So I think this will, you know, have industrial and big commercial applications, not necessarily, home use. But
I mean, I guess it will all come down to cost. The thing is, if we're also getting rid of the nuclear waste, that's the thing that gets me, is that
yes,
you have to consider the cost of storing that waste. Right. So, you know, when you're deciding if this is cost effective or not, what if we turned all of our nuclear waste into this stuff? Would that be cost effective just as a way of storing the waste? And then the electricity is a bonus?
The UK alone has 95,000 tons of it. 95,000 tons of this stuff. And they're just looking, trying to figure out, trying to think outside the box. What could we do? And this is certainly a way to do it. Because remember, like I said, once you evaporate away the carbon-14, you still have radioactive graphite, but it's much easier to deal with than how it was taken right out of the reactor.
Yeah.
So they got to do some number crunch and figure out, you know, what kind of savings are they really talking about here, and how much of a demand will there be for these little, you know, these little diamonds that can power things for so long, but with just, you know, not much power, but can do it for centuries.
Basically forever. Yeah, you know.
Right.
Longer than whatever technology you're putting it in, basically.
Absolutely.
Right.
So pretty
interesting.
Cool. Yeah, it was fun. Fun to look into.
Okay, Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
All right, guys. Who's That Noisy? Last week, I played this noisy. Tons of submissions, tons of people guessing the right answer. But before we go on, I wanted to play you something that it completely reminded me of this.
Kodos the Executioner. Summary. governor of Tarsus for 20 Earth years ago.
Right? From Star Trek. The computer from Star Trek.
Sure.
Yes.
Yeah, the monotone, yeah. The scanning speech.
Right. We can't I love speech. That.
Love it.
So, do you guys know what it is?
It's a number station.
It's the Star Trek computer.
Correct.
A German Excellent German thought. Number station.
German.
Yes, okay. That's you're both correct. So
I heard Achtung
at the beginning and the end.
Attention.
Attention. Yeah.
Right? So guys, what were number stations for?
Attention.
secret coded communications.
Yep. Ooh. That's one of them.
Clandestine operations. So
it's like governments communicating with spies, or it could be drug smuggling operations. Probably the first one I mentioned is more likely. So what is a number station? It's a radio broadcast where, like, you know, seemingly random digits were being read off, but it was coded. So it's just coded that the person that day, like on that date, they had a pad that said this is what the decoding is for any transmissions that are sent out on this date. And then they would just get rid of that page and go to the next page and the next page and the next page in their code decode book. So lots of different people could pick up these transmissions, but they had no idea what they meant unless you had the key. So like I said, tons of people wrote in. Tons of people. The winner is Jorge alias, or George's alias, if that's your real name. And he said it's a shortwave number station with radio teletype, RTTY, sideband noise in the background, common during the Cold War, but still occasionally used.
Yep.
Very good, and you won. That's great. But there was someone that had a notable, for the first time, I'm giving this guy a notable answer. This was Eric Von Otter, and Eric said, "Hi, guys. This week's Who's That Noisy fascinated me and sent me on a deep dive into the far reaches of the interwebs. Thanks for that. Based on my research, the Noisy is an East German number station operated by the East German National People's Army, the NVA. The message is now known by the name gongs or chimes due to the sound or music preceding the recorded message, which you cleverly left out. It also goes by the identifier Enigma ID G03. And the guy did a deep dive and got, you know, hit the nail right on the head. Anyway, I have a new Who's That Noisy. This one was sent in by a listener named Ian H. My only clue is pay close attention to how it ends. If you think you know what that is, and I suspect very few will, but, you know, if you know, write it in. I'm not going to make you have to get incredibly specific on this one. Just, you know, give me a general idea what it is. Write to me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org with your guess and any cool things you heard this week.
All right. Thank you, Jay. Kara, ¿qué es la palabra?
La palabra es endemic. Actually, it's funny that you asked that in Spanish, because I thought of this word a couple years ago when I went to the Galapagos for Christmas vacation, and it was awesome. And I realized that while we were in the Galapagos, the guides, the naturalists who would take us to the different islands, kept using the term endemic over and over. And at one point I stopped her and was like, or she would say native, and then she would say endemic, and then she would say introduced. And at one point I was like, can you explain what all of these terms mean? So a simple definition, and there's a few different ones. Something is endemic if it belongs or is native to a particular people or country. It is a characteristic of or it's prevalent in a particular field, area, or environment. And the definition that I was more focused on is restricted or peculiar to a locality or region. So if we talk about an endemic disease or an endemic species, it is specific to a region. So it's important to kind of differentiate between some of those terms that I mentioned, like endemic, native, and introduced, especially when we're talking about ecology. An organism is endemic if it evolved and occurs and breeds naturally only in that one area. So something might be endemic to the Galapagos if it only exists in the Galapagos. It's native if it exists in that place, but it might also exist in other places. But what makes it native is that it got there on its own, meaning that, you know, maybe a bird or a plant species, like a seed, was drifted over to an island or was brought to that island naturally by an animal. It's introduced if human beings brought it to that area. So something can be both native and endemic, but like things that are endemic are also native, but things that are native are not also necessarily endemic, if that makes sense.
Yeah, they could be, but they're not necessarily.
They could be, yeah. So something that's native could also exist in another region. So it is kind of important to tell those different words apart, especially if you are interested in ecology, because they're used quite a lot. Now, I looked up the etymology of endemic, and as a full term, actually endemical, it first came about in the 1650s, and its root words are Greek. The endemos, or en portion, actually the full portion means native or dwelling, as we kind of talked to, or of or belonging to a people. But when you break it down, en, which is the prefix in, I-N-E-N, you see it across the board, means in, and demos actually refers to people or to a district. So it's interesting that kind of the original definition actually seems to be the one that's more about something being endemic to a particular people, but it then evolved to become a stronger term in ecology referring to actual organisms.
Is that the same root as in the word democracy?
Yeah, demos, like for the common people, in common use. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And district, too. So common people and district was kind of interchangeable. So more like society or like the general people that lived in that region.
Yeah. Of course, I'm mostly familiar with the term endemic with respect to diseases. And an endemic disease does not have to be specific to a location. It just means that it's self-sustaining in that location.
Gotcha. Like you talk about,
yeah, measles is endemic to the United States if – the measles is self-sustaining within the U.S. If it's no longer endemic, but it could still be introduced from the outside, right? So there could be outbreaks.
Gotcha.
There could be outbreaks of measles, but it's not endemic unless it's self-sustaining here.
I thought measles was actually not endemic.
It's not. It's not endemic.
Yeah,
I'm just saying it used to be. It used to be endemic. And then that's also the difference between eradicating a disease and eliminating a disease. So measles has been eliminated in the United States because it's no longer endemic. But it hasn't been eradicated from the world.
Yeah.
Which is what eradicating means. Now, in addition, there's also epidemics, right, which is – An epidemic is a disease so you have an outbreak, and then an epidemic is basically a outbreak that extends over a large area, and then a pandemic, which is
multiple
all
countries.
Over the world. Yeah, basically intercontinental or whatever. So like the 1918 flu was a pandemic. You know, that basically went everywhere.
Yeah, and so the etymology of the epi prefix, also Greek, epi meaning upon or near to or in addition to, and then pan is actually started Latin. Yeah, and that is actually, that's weird, dish. Because they're different pans. Maybe I should put, all every hole. But also pan refers to a dish, you see it in some words. That's interesting. But yeah, so upon, near to, in addition to, or every all whole inclusive.
All right, guys, I have a name that logical fallacy this week. This one comes from a listener. So he gives up an anecdote, which is actually not necessary to understand the question. So I'm just going to skip that and just cut to his question. He asks, is there a term for when somebody accuses you of employing a logical fallacy without sufficient reason to make that claim? Is there not a principle of innocent until proven guilty in debate that we should assume that evidence was chosen with due diligence until given reason to think otherwise, that our opponent is of right mind and weighing multiple considerations until he or she fails to? Intellectual generosity, maybe? So there's really two questions in there. The first one is, what do you call it when somebody falsely or unfairly accuses you of committing a logical fallacy? And what's the principle that they're not adhering to? Is there some kind of principle of fairness in a debate? What do you guys think about that?
We could say non sequitur. I mean, loosely, you could say it doesn't follow.
Every logical fallacy is a non sequitur.
So aha!
That's not specific.
Oh,
That's the top level. All logical fallacies are non sequiturs.
So I'm right then? Is that what you're saying?
Well, but there is a specific fallacy. There's a term we use to refer to that, and it's called the fallacy fallacy.
Yeah, the fallacy. I wasn't sure, but I thought I'd heard that before.
So this is very common. I know we've touched upon this before. It's very common, especially since, you know, the skeptical movement, I think, has done a good job of raising awareness of the various logical fallacies. And again, for a very quick review, the logical fallacies we are talking about are informal logical fallacies, meaning they're not always fallacies. They're context dependent. They're not statements that have to be wrong. It's just that it's sloppy thinking, and the context is very important to knowing whether or not it's really valid. So, like, for example, we talk a lot about argument from authority. Well, it's actually reasonable to refer to a consensus of scientific opinion. That's not necessarily the fallacy of argument from authority. But if you say, well, this one guy thinks this is true, therefore it's true, that's an argument from authority. So you have to understand the context in which the argument is used. Not all appeals to authority are fallacious, right? Very similar to like a slippery slope argument, you know, fallacy. Well, sometimes it's reasonable to argue that, you know, certain factors will lead to more extreme examples. They don't necessarily, that's why it's a fallacy, because it doesn't necessarily lead to more extreme versions, but it might. And so it depends on exactly what argument you're using. My advice is always to use your knowledge of logical fallacies to police your own thinking. Don't use it as a weapon against your enemies, because chances are you're going to be falling for the fallacy. And the other component to that is to say, aha, I can frame what you said to make it sound like a logical fallacy. Therefore, I win. Therefore, I'm right and you're wrong. And that is also incorrect. Even if somebody is actually committing a logical fallacy, that doesn't mean that they're wrong.
Mean you're right.
Because they could be right despite the fact that in that one instance, they're marshaling an invalid argument to defend their position. So that's also the fallacy. It's assuming that because somebody is using an invalid argument that their conclusion is wrong, and that's not necessarily true. Their conclusion could happen to be correct, even though that they are defending it with a fallacious argument, an invalid bit of logic. So those two things are the fallacy. Very common. I see that now in the comments, like to our Facebook page, all the time. Oh, that's a straw man. That's a whatever. And of course, we do that too. But you got to be very careful that you're using it in an instructive way, not as a weapon, not as a rhetorical trick to try to undercut the other side, or to try to as a shortcut to winning. It's like, oh, I pointed out a fallacy, therefore I win. Don't use it that way. The other part of his question is there a principle of innocent until proven guilty? And I know we've talked about this too, but it's good to remind people of this. You guys know what we're talking about here? What's the principle? What's that principle called? To try to frame your opponent's position in the best possible light.
Oh, we just talked about
that. Yeah, that's the principle of charity, intellectual charity. He said generosity, that's close, but the technical term that philosophers would use would be charity. And what that means is it's the opposite of a straw man, right? The straw man is when you construct a version of the other side that you're arguing against that's deliberately weak, so that you can argue against your artificially weakened version of their position or the other position. What you should be doing is giving any benefit of the doubt to the other side and to try to frame their point of view, their position, in the strongest possible way. Because if you can still shoot it down, if you can still argue that it's flawed, then your position is probably solid, is probably strong. So you're showing confidence in your own position. But also, it is, I think, just good form. Even if for nothing else, just as a way of avoiding the straw man. And I think since people there's a tendency to portray the other side in simplistic negative terms, you almost have to, you know, the principle of charity is like a balancing force. You know, you have to do that just to be fair, just to be somewhere in the middle. You guys, I'm sure you've been in arguments all the time where you say something and then someone's, oh, you're saying this, right? And they give this ridiculous caricature of what you just said. It's so frustrating. Well, don't be that person. Don't do that. It's because it is very frustrating. You should understand and adhere to the principle of charity, because if you're correct, you can be charitable to the other side and still you'll have the solid position, right? You'll still be able to defend your position. So the principle of charity, remember, so don't commit the fallacy, but do try to be charitable when you're in a discussion with somebody else. I think those are two very good skeptical principles.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake. And then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one they think is the fake. Are you guys ready for this week? Three regular news items, no theme. Or
yes.
Themeless this week. All right, here we go. Item number one. Physicists studying solar cells may have discovered why most plants on Earth are green. Item number two. Researchers have published the first estimate of the mass of the technosphere, 30 trillion tons, or 50 kilograms per square meter of Earth's surface. And item number three, astronomers have identified the tiniest known asteroid, measuring about 200 millimeters in average diameter. Jay, go first.
Physicists that are studying solar cells think they discovered why most planets on Earth are green. I thought that was because of chlorophyll, but does that color have anything to do with solar absorption?
So obviously it's a deeper level why. Yes, because of chlorophyll, but...
All right, so if this is real, then it's something deeper than that. Okay. All right, let me move on. The second one here, researchers that published this first estimate of the mass of the technosphere, which is... That's where people, they go out dancing, Evan. If you didn't know what a technosphere is.
You guys, I mean, that's pretty self-explanatory, right? Do you want me to give you an operational definition of technosphere?
Yes, please.
It's basically all our stuff. It's just everything people have built.
Oh, gotcha. Okay, yeah. So it doesn't have to be, like, technological.
And all our waste. All of our stuff that we've built and all of the waste, yeah. Everything is basically produced by people.
Yeah, so you got 30 trillion tons... Or 50 kilograms per square meter of stuff. Whoa, 30 trillion tons. Now, that's globally. That's everything. That's the whole technosphere.
Of the Earth, yeah.
30 trillion tons. I'm trying to figure out, like, oh, God. I can't even remember what a big, like, 747 weighs. 30 trillion tons. That seems like a lot. But that's, you know, okay. Interesting. In this last one, astronomers have identified the tiniest known asteroid, measuring about 200 millimeters in average diameter. What do you mean they've identified the tiniest known? They found the one that they're... Okay, they found an asteroid that is considered to be the smallest known asteroid.
I mean, they found it, confirmed it, characterized its orbit. I mean, they, you know, all that good stuff.
200 millimeters in average diameter. That seems small for them to, you know, to identify... 200 millimeters is not a lot of millimeters. And how could they have found it? I think that one's the fake because that's too small.
Okay, Bob?
That's pretty cool that somebody connected solar cells with why most plants are green. Yeah, I guess I can see that. Let's see. The mass of the technosphere, 30 trillion tons. Yeah, that sounds right. 30 trillion tons.
Bob's like, 30 trillion. That's about what I figured.
I was thinking more.
Give or take a trillion.
27 trillion, but 30 is in the ballpark. No, I mean, think about it. All of our shit, including buildings and bridges and everything.
Bob, it's your shit. It's my stuff. Get that right.
Right. So, and, you know, once you get into 30 trillion and then tons, I mean, who could really have a full grasp? It sounds in the ballpark. So I'm going to go with that one. Let's see. So, Jay agrees with me about the tiniest asteroid. 200 millimeters is just too tiny. I mean, I would think it'd be much bigger than 200 millimeters. So that's the only one that's leaping out at me. So I'm going to say that is fiction.
Okay. Kara?
Yeah, okay. Solar cells may have discovered why most planets on Earth are green. That one's just a weird enigma to me. Like, it's so open-ended and vague. I don't know. green is the color of chlorophyll, which is in the chloroplast. Like, what? Ugh. I guess this is more talking about the rays that are coming off of the sun and why, like, utilizing a green wavelength is the best and some sort of explanation for that. So, yeah, of course, I think somebody who studies the sun would be able to determine some sort of outcome of why plants respond to the sun the way they do.
Well, actually, the green would be reflected, so it doesn't care about the green.
Yeah, exactly. Like, why it would be absorbing the wavelengths that it absorbs. Because not all plants are green. Some are purple and some are, you know, red. And then obviously there's changes throughout the year. So let's see. Researchers have published the first estimate of the mass of the technosphere. I love that. It's so one of those things where, like, we need a study in scale. Because it's like 30 trillion tons is such a meaningless number to me. Like, comparing it to the mass of human people on the planet, I would think that it would be like 100 times or 1,000 times how heavy people themselves are. Maybe that would tell me something. I don't know.
Well, that's why I put the 50 kilograms per square meter, because then you could wrap your head around that easier than the 30 kind of tons.
Convert tons to kilograms.
Who the hell measures in kilograms?
Right. Yeah. What country are we in?
Scientists do.
Pounds,
yeah, it's
baby.
Still kind of weird. Stone. Like this idea of like weight per area, and I don't know. It's just one of those things where I'm so out of touch with what these numbers would really mean.
Right,
I know
me
it's
too.
Gratuitous. Let me see. And then astronomers have identified the tiniest known asteroid. To me, like everybody else, this one seems to be the fiction only because I know that satellites and, well, asteroid though, it's not a meteorite or space debris. But I do know that, like, you know, the space station and satellites and stuff often get dinged by things that are so small that we can't detect them. So it seems weird that we would be able to detect an asteroid, which is probably much farther away, that's that tiny. So I'm going to go with everybody else and say that's too small.
And Evan.
Well, don't leave me alone here.
You got something else for us?
No, you guys pretty much hit on everything. And I think in some ways, starting with Jay, he read my mind because if I had to go first, I would have agreed with him and said that the 200 millimeter for average diameter of that asteroid. Nope. I don't buy it. So, yeah. Fiction.
Okay, so I guess we'll start with number one. Physicists studying solar cells may have discovered why most plants on Earth are green. You guys all think this one is science, and this one is science.
Of course.
Science.
Yeah. This is easy, but this is a cool, cool news item. So, the physicists were studying solar cells right now. One of the big limiting factors in the efficiency of photovoltaics is that there's lots of fluctuations in the amount of sun that would be hitting, right? And so you have to have some way of keeping them from either overheating or producing too much voltage at any one time. You have to, you know, level it out off. And that, you know, this leveling off, regulating, you know, the amount of electricity that they're producing actually is a significant source of inefficiency. This actually reminded me of the news item from last week about how the plants, you know, adjust, you know, they bleed off heat, you know, they adjust their temperature so that they don't get burned by the sun. So same thing with solar panels. So they were trying to figure out a way to produce solar cells that are more efficient in the way they regulate the amount of energy, the amount of heat that they're producing. And what they found was that if they have, instead of having a photocell that responds to one color, you have two different types of photocells that are responding to two different colors. And one of those colors is high energy and one is low energy. And then you can, the system can automatically adjust how much energy it's producing simply by adjusting the ratio of either the high energy versus low energy photocells that are being used. And they found that the system was able to regulate itself automatically when you do this, and this eliminates the need to have separate regulators that are regulating the voltage. And this could lead to a significant increase in the efficiency of solar cells, right?
How much more?
Five of these news items a week, but you know, maybe might increase the efficiency of solar panels. But the interesting bit was what they realized, this is where the plants in green come in, they realized that plants can use the same system with their pigments, and that the color green is of absolutely no value in regulating the temperature in this kind of system, regulating the energy. So, because when you think about it, you know, the most radiant portion of the solar power spectrum per unit wavelength is in the green part of the spectrum.
Yeah, green, yellow, yeah.
Yeah, so why aren't plants using the high energy per unit wavelength part of the spectrum? Why are they reflecting all of that green away? Why aren't they using it to make energy, to grow, you know, to make do photosynthesis? Well, if they evolve this, you know, two-part auto-regulatory system, then the wavelengths and the color green are of no help to that. They would you know, be absorbing light on either side of green and reflecting green. So that's actually consistent with what we see, that most plants, in fact, reflect away the green, which is not useful for this system. So that's, I said may because this is, you know, just, you know, hypothetical at this point. But it's interesting that it provides a physics explanation where we don't really have one now. I mean, previously, biologists just had to say, well, you know, evolution is contingent, you know, because whatever, the chemicals that plants evolved to do photosynthesis, like chlorophyll, or happen to be green, even though it's not maximally efficient, that's what happened. But it does, you know, that's not a satisfying answer, especially since photosynthesis is so ancient and there's been so much time for evolution to tweak it. You would think that plants would be the optimal color. Like, in fact, why aren't they black? You know, why aren't they absorbing all of the wavelengths of the sunlight hitting them? And well, if they're absorbing everything except for the one in the middle, the green one, then that enables them to you know, automatically regulate their energy. That could be an explanation. That's a more satisfying explanation. They still need to prove that that's actually true, but that's a very interesting hypothesis. Isn't that cool?
Yeah, that was cool.
Very.
Yeah. All right. So these other two items, technosphere being 30 trillion tons and the asteroid being 200 millimeters, one of those is off by an order of magnitude.
Uh-huh. So I think it's the millimeters.
Which one is it?
Maybe
it's 3 trillion tons or 300 trillion tons.
And no, I would have no idea. It would be the exact same in my mind if it was 30 or 300.
It's definitely 200 millimeters.
It's got to be.
I think it was 20 millimeters. It was 20 millimeters in diameter.
Because the order of magnitude when you're talking about trillions isn't as in your face as going from the low end with 200 millimeters. That's a big difference. Whereas 3 trillion or 30 trillion, you know.
It's the same size difference.
But that's kind of my rule of thumb. If I'm going to make a number a fiction, I'll go up or down by an order of magnitude. All right. We'll start with number two. Researchers have published the first estimate of the mass of the technosphere, 30 trillion tons or 50 kilograms per square meter of Earth's surface. You guys all think that is science, and that one is science.
Yes.
Science,
baby. We are on our way to the WALL-E universe. Awesome.
Yeah. I had to use that one because technosphere is so cool.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
I love that word.
I know. It is awesome.
And this is the first time they actually estimated the mass of the technosphere. Obviously, there's, you know, a lot of wiggle room in there. But
Steve, the first time I came across the word technosphere years ago reading science fiction, and they were talking about how artificial intelligence was developed and how it pretty much changed everything. And they refer to that event in human history as a spike in the technosphere. Yeah. And I never forgot that quote.
Yeah, it is interesting to think about that. We are creating this sphere of technological stuff on the Earth, and it's rapidly changing, you know. Here's another little factoid that I came across when reading about it. There, if you look at the technosphere, you know, as a thing, and, you know, you could essentially analogize each type of thing that you find in the technosphere to a species, right, like a fossil species, there are more technological species than there are biological species in the biosphere.
Sure. Wow.
There's more different kinds of technological stuff that we are leaving behind in the Earth than there are species that you could identify in the fossil record.
Technofossils, baby.
Yeah.
I talked about that a couple years ago. It's proliferating like crazy.
So all of that means that astronomers have identified the tiniest known asteroid measuring about 200 millimeters in average diameter. That is the fiction because the tiniest known asteroid is 2 meters or about 6 feet across. Still tiny. That is still a small piece of rock.
Sure is.
6 feet, not 200 millimeters, but that is still still tiny. So how even a 6 feet across leads to the question of how could we see something so small? So the two features that you might suspect that would relate to our ability to see it are in play here. So one is that it's close. We first identified it when it passed. It did a close approach on the Earth. Let's see. It was within the orbit of the moon. It was only 128,000 kilometers away. So pretty close. That was in October 2015.
Ooh, I love when they come in the orbit of the moon.
Yeah. And it's also really bright. It's extremely bright. It's got a very high albedo. And because it's a certain kind of asteroid that is only about 1 in 1,000 asteroids that we've or that that become meteorites that land on the Earth are of this type. It's called an aubrite, A-U-B-R-I-T-E. They consist of very bright minerals, mostly silicates. About 1/1,000th of the asteroids out there, if the meteorites are any, the sampling of stuff that hits the Earth is accurate. So it's rare. These are rare. But this one happens to be close and very bright, and so we were able to see it. It's actually one of the brightest asteroids out there, even though it's so tiny. Only 2 meters or about 6 feet across. Very neat.
Definitely not 200 millimeters.
It's a near-Earth asteroid. Well, good job, everyone.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Trying to get your averages up before the end of the year is only a couple of weeks.
That's that generosity we were talking about earlier. Thanks, Steve.
Charity, Evan. That's charity.
Charity, yes.
So don't forget, everyone, there's still time to send us your votes for your favorite SGU bit of the year, favorite quote of the year, favorite news item, skeptical hero of the year, skeptical jackass of the year. Anything interesting you want to remember about the SGU and science and skepticism this year, send it in. 2016 review in the subject line to add info@theskepticsguide.org. We're going to record this in a couple of weeks, and it's always the last show that we air in the calendar year. It's a lot of fun. A lot of fun looking back.
Please, please send these in, people. I remember 3 episodes this past year, and what we record? We recorded like, 20 of them? I mean, I don't remember any of those. So please send that in because it – oh, yeah, it was more than 20. What? See, I don't even remember how many we recorded.
Roughly 52.
We really use those. It really is helpful to refresh our memories of what exactly happened this past year.
Anything that sticks out, Evan, do you have a quote for us?
I do, a really good one. This job is a great scientific adventure, but it's also a great human adventure. Mankind has made giant steps forward. However, what we know is really very, very little compared to what we still have to know. And that was said by a woman named Fabiola Giannotti. She is a Higgs boson physicist. She's not only a Higgs boson physicist. She is currently the CERN Director General, the first woman to have held this position. And her mandate began on the 1st of January, 2016. She'll be in this position for 5 years.
A 5-year journey.
And I like this quote because
that's awesome.
It reminds us all that we have discovered so, so much as mankind, especially, even in just the last 150, 200 years. But compared to what is knowable, it's so, so small. I mean, the universe is still out there to be had. It's like this massive untapped resource, which is just, fills me with wonder and fascination and, just an incredible, incredible thought. So I thought she put that very well.
Yeah, I think this whole science thing is really working out.
I think the jury's out a little bit, but
we should keep going with that. I think
it's got promise.
That's going to be one of your new quotes, Evan.
This whole science thing.
I think it's working out.
It's working out all right.
All right, guys. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Thank you. Surely.
Thanks, Doctor.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible.